Okay, so we're reading from the ninth canto, chapter 10, text 3. Translation. O King Parikit, the transcendental activities of Lord Ramachandra have been described by great saintly persons who have seen the truth. Because you have heard again and again about Lord Ramachandra, the husband of Mother Sita, I shall describe these activities only in brief. Please listen. Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Modern Rakshasas, posing as educationally advanced merely because they have doctorates, have tried to prove that Lord Ramachandra is not the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but an ordinary person. But those who are learned and spiritually advanced will never accept such notions. Shishi Radha Gokulananda Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman Ki Jai. They will accept the descriptions of Lord Ramachandra and his activities only as presented by Tattvadarshis, those who know the absolute truth. In Bhagavad Gita 4:34, the Supreme Personality of Godhead advises, Tadvidi pranipatena pari prashnena sevaya upadekyanti te jnanam jnaninas tatvadarshina. Just try to learn the truth by approaching a spiritual master. Inquire from him submissively and render service unto him. The self-realized soul can impart knowledge unto you because he has seen the truth. Unless one is Tattvadarshi in complete knowledge of the absolute truth, one cannot describe the activities of the personality of Godhead. Therefore, although there are many so-called Ramayans or histories of Lord Ramachandra's activities, some of them are not actually authoritative. Sometimes Lord Ramachandra's activities are described in terms of one's own imaginations, speculations or material sentiments. But the characteristics of Lord Ramachandra should not be handled as something imaginary. While describing the history of Lord Ramachandra, Shukadev Goswami told Maharaj Parikit, "You have already heard about the activities of Lord Ramachandra." Apparently, therefore, 5,000 years ago, there were many Ramayans or histories of Lord Ramachandra's activities, and there are many still. But we must select only those books written by Tattvadarshis, Gyaninas Tattvadarshina, not the books of so-called scholars who claim knowledge only on the basis of a doctorate. This is a warning by Shukadev Goswami, Rishi Bis Tattvadarshi Bi. Although the Ramayana composed by Valmiki is a huge literature, the same activities are summarized here by Shukadev Goswami in a few verses. So thank you, Prabhu, for allowing me to be with you today. And Maharaj, please give me your blessings to speak in your presence, and everyone else. I'm certainly not qualified. But this verse is at the beginning of the descriptions of Lord Rama. I've been asked to speak a little bit on that sort of theme, because, of course, we're approaching Ram Navami. In this purport, of course, there are many points, but specifically, the main point that I understood is that Srila Prabhupada is saying that the activities of the Lord, his divine Leela, should not be presented by those who are not Tattvadarshan. And what I understand by that is that, we should not present anything different from what has already been presented by those who are accepted as such persons, as the seers of the truth, such as Valmiki. And of course, there are numerous other versions of the Ramayana floating around, as we know, and commentaries on Ramayana, and probably the most popular one these days, is not written by a Tattvadarshi. So I think Srila Prabhupada, although not directly stating it, is alluding to many of these unauthorized books. And he's saying that anyone who presents misleading accounts of the Lord is a Rakshasa. Because effectively, they're obscuring the truth. They're not presenting the truth. Of course, some of them go as far as to say that Ram is not actually God, that, you know, he's, at the end of the day, a manifestation of the impersonal Brahman, or he's an ordinary man who attained some power, some godhood, which I can also do, and you can also do, of course. We can all do that. if we simply meditate long enough, we'll get there. And so these are being described as the Rakshasas, of course. Their business is to eliminate God from the equation. Somehow, they don't like the idea of God because he presents an obstacle to their enjoyment, an impediment. People who are very strongly attached to material enjoyment are disconcerted by the idea that there is a supreme enjoyer to whom everything should be given, and namely that's God. Bhogaishvarya prashaktanam daya parita chetasam. So they, due to bhoga, wanting to be the enjoyers and the controllers themselves, they're opposed to God. They may not even understand why. Within themselves, they have this like aversion, this enmity to the Lord. But this is where it stems from, deep attachments to material enjoyment, which have not yet been beaten out of them by the process of material rectification. Of course, that will happen in due course, but it can take some time for some of us. Modern Rakshasa, of course, Rakshasa is not a new phenomenon. Prabhupada says 5,000 years ago, it seems, from this verse, there were bogus accounts of Ram and what have you. And of course, in the Ramayana itself, there are some nice descriptions of the Rakshasas, how they originated and their mentality and their plan to somehow get Vishnu out of the way, destroy him somehow. Literally, in the case of the early Rakshasas. Actually, the Rakshasas began, there's different accounts of how they began. I guess it's, different kalpas, different stories, sometimes this way, sometimes that way. The creation isn't always identical. At the end of Brahma's day, everything up to his planet is swallowed up. And then he does it again, so I think he exercises his creative ability to do things in a slightly different way. Maybe he gets bored and do it a different way this time, get the Rakshasas in another way. So the Rakshasas, the one way I saw, different ways, but this way, they were initially, Raksha means to protect, and they were meant to protect, they were the protectors. they started off okay, reasonably okay, and then they actually had the city of Lanka built by Vishwakarma. right in the very beginning of their race, they approached him and said, we'd like a nice, wonderful city of gold with jewels and so many things adorning it. And Vishwakarma constructed Lanka, and they began to live there. And then, you know, with all this opulence and wealth and physical beauty and power that they possessed, they got puffed up. As is often the case, which is usually why we find Krishna keeps his devotees impoverished, because it's not got much to be proud of when you haven't got anything. But they had a lot, so they were getting puffed up. And then they began to think, well, you know, we're the big guys around here. And they began to assail the gods, as they do. The Rakshasa began to attack them. They took exception to the gods and their opulence and position and power. And they thought, well, you know, why should they be worshipped over and above us? We deserve some of this. So they set about rectifying the situation as far as they could see it. And they began to pummel the gods quite severely, killing quite a lot of them. And so then the gods became very concerned, and as they always do under those conditions, they went to Lord Vishnu and said, "Help, Pahimam, save us, because these Rakshasas are, you know, causing us plenty of aggravation." Vishnu said, "Yes, Tatastu, I shall become angry and take care of business for you. Don't fear anymore." First, actually, the gods went to Lord Shiva and asked him, and he said, "Well, I shall not kill them because they've been granted boons that they're immune from me, but I'll tell you someone who will surely kill them." And you go and ask him, that's Lord Narayan. So, of course, they went to Lord Narayan. Lord Narayan said, "Yeah, leave it to me. That's no problem." So, anyway, word reached the gods. I think at that time, not the gods, the Rakshasas, Malayavan, Sumali, and Mali were like the big leaders of the Rakshasas. And Malayavan had this mystic vision. He could understand, oh, the gods have approached Narayan. And he's, you know, promised to help them out. So then they were consulting together, the Rakshasas, and they were saying, "Well, you know, we don't really have any argument with Vishnu. I mean, you know, we don't really want to fight Vishnu because think about it, you know, he's pretty hard to defeat. He's already crushed Hiranyaksha, Hiranyakashipu, you know, big long list of powerful demons, Shumba, Nishumba, Hardikya, Radeya, all these massive Rakshasas of the past that he'd killed. He said, they're heard of no more, all these great forefathers of ours, because they were wiped out by Vishnu. So maybe, you know, we don't have to fight with him. The problem is that he's had his mind corrupted by the gods. You know, they've gone there, these twisted and deceitful gods, and they've corrupted Vishnu's mind against us. So the thing about Rakshasas is they don't think we're the Rakshasas, we're the bad guys. And, you know, we're evil. They actually think we're okay. We're good. You know, we're the good guys, actually. I was looking when I was, you know, and, you know, the actual good guys, they're hypocrites, they're deceitful, they're proud, they think they're something special. They really believe that they are the, you know, the religious and pious, charitable guys, you know, the good ones, whilst the gods, the devas and devotees, are quite the opposite. And that's their mentality. So, you know, they started out like thinking like this. Well, you know, Vishnu, he's had a bad association with those evil, deceitful gods. And, you know, now he's got this idea in his head that he should kill us. And I was just, I was reading this in the 16th chapter of the Gita, how the mentality of the Rakshasas is very nicely described. You know, first of all, fundamentally, it's, you know, a satyam, a pratishtam te jagat ahur anishvaram, that, you know, there's no truth in them, and, you know, they don't believe in the origin of the universe coming from a person, from God. Somehow or another it came about, like the modern Rakshasas, you know, the Big Bang. There was nothing, and then suddenly there was something. It's a singularity. It could never happen again, but it did happen somehow, and you better believe it. And if you don't believe it, you're just a weird follower of some strange religious cult. We're very intelligent. We've got it all worked out. You know, no problem. But, you know, so these are how the Rakshasas operate. Jagat Ahura Nishvaram, that there is no God. And again, you know, they may not understand the fundamental basis of why they're thinking like that, but the Gita explains it very nicely, that Rogashraya, that it's a very strong desire to enjoy. And when you examine these people somewhat closely, you'll see that this is their ethos. Their life is all about drinking fine wine and, you know, going to the cinema and going to the theater rather, and having mistresses. And I mean, I don't want to get into the sordid details of their life, but lives. But inevitably, you'll see, you know, that they actually do fit the mold very nicely of being hugely attached to material enjoyment, and thus hugely opposed to the supreme enjoyer. And they don't necessarily even understand themselves why that is. And, you know, they have the same mood towards devotees who represent God. They instantly are like, you know, when you come across them, you experience that. Anyway, I'll have a look at this after. Jagala Prabhatimcha, Nivritimcha, they don't know what to do, what not to do. And these are the characteristics of the Rakshasas. Asatyam Aparaspara Sambhutam Kimanyat Kamahoit. They say that this world is unreal, with no foundation, no God in control. They say it is produced of sex desire and has no cause other than lust. So yeah, this is really describing them quite succinctly and nicely. And it's interesting because, you know, Srila Prabhupada is also alluding here to other kinds of Rakshasas who are not necessarily the, you know, the big enjoyers. They have another idea. And that is that, you know, they've tried that. And of course, material enjoyment is never going to work. It's never going to satisfy us because we're spiritual beings. We're meant for spiritual happiness. So becoming frustrated with that, they then, some of them break away and, you know, will become Buddhists or will become, you know, some impersonalists ultimately. And frustrated, like the sour grapes thing, Prabhupada describes it, the jackal. He's jumping, can't reach the grapes. Finally, they're sour anyway, they're rubbish. You know, why did I want those grapes? So this is the impersonalist, who still fundamentally at heart doesn't want to accept God because he still actually wants to enjoy. But he's got a different idea now about how he can enjoy. And that is by giving everything up and achieving some sort of state of bliss, which they nirvana, you know, ananda. So their conception changes. And this is interesting here because asatyam, you know, one of the things they say is that it's all illusion. It's not real. Nothing is real. God is not real. Krishna's pastimes, ultimately, they're all displays of Maya. So this is another form of a Rakshasa. Although externally, he may look like a very nice person. He's very gentle, you know, Dalai Lama, whatever he calls himself. So many things, you know, speaking very nicely. But, you know, fundamentally, is this desire to enjoy the material energy, either by seizing it and trying to squeeze something out of it, or by I'll reject it, I'll find my inner bliss, connect with my bliss, you know, and something like that. So it's me I want to enjoy. So they'll try that for some millions and millions of years, and then again fall down and have another go. So it goes on. So this is a description of the Rakshasas in the modern age. So these ancient Rakshasas, going back to the account, having heard that Vishnu had sided with the gods, they said, okay, well, the solution to this problem is we'll just go and wipe out the gods. That'll solve the problem. We won't be any further issues arising from them. And we can live peacefully, and yeah, Vishnu, he can do his thing, that's fine, we'll get along. But the gods have got to be eliminated. So, yeah, they took up their weapons, mounted their chariots, and out they went. And they were riding, you know, the backs of dolphins and tigers, boars, you know, all kinds of strange animals, as they do, and looked like a massive sea of a huge dark sea swarming out of Lanka towards the abode of the gods. And so, of course, when they took off like that, Vishnu, true to his word, mounted on the back of Garuda, taking up his Sharanga, his, you know, his bow, his sword, his conch, his discus, in his four hands, riding on Garuda. And so he began to descend from the sky, and it's described that it's a beautiful sight. Like Garuda's, you know, he's a huge eagle. He's not like a massive eagle just coming down. He goes, whoosh, his wings like that. It created a wind which blew away half of the Rakshasa army right from the start. Just the wind from his wings, which of course at the same time is vibrating the sounds of the Vedas. It's Am Veda. It's a very beautiful sound. And as Vishnu is descending, he's surrounded by Siddhas, Gandharvas, different gods, Urgas, Nargas, and they're all praising him. And he's sight of, you know, very beautiful. It's described, he looks like a dark cloud coming down from Mount Meru with lightning, because he's wearing these beautiful yellow garments, hugely effulgent, so beautiful. And the Rakshasas are looking up, oh, Vishnu, here it comes again. You know, and it's like, and they can't even look at him, he's so brilliant. They're like, ugh, it's dazzled by his brilliance. But nevertheless, they think, okay, well, we better attack him, you know, otherwise it's not gonna be good. So they began to shower their arrows on him, weapons and all kinds of different missiles launched at him. And it's described in the Ramayana that the arrows of the Rakshasas entered the body of Vishnu, who looked like a big hill of antimony, a big blue hill in the midst of them all. Like, you know, moths entering a fire, or bees entering a pot of honey, alligators entering the ocean, or all the worlds entering Vishnu at the time of the deluge. So all these beautiful poetic descriptions are given in the Ramayana, all these arrows going towards Vishnu. But, of course, he's unmoved by that. And he responds in kind of, first thing he did was to take up his great conch, and he blew his conch as it's a terrific sound, and the sound so immense that like all the demons, their horses are falling over, they're dropping out of their chariots, the elephants are frozen solid. The mere sound of his conch was so terrific and terrifying that practically stopped them in their tracks. But anyway, the battle went on, and the outcome, can any of you guess how it ended? They were hammered, so they had to go. Then they skulked off down to the lower planets. At that point, they couldn't go back to Lanka, and they descended down to the nether regions, Rasatala, Atala, all these planets, as seven planetary systems beneath the Earth, where the sun doesn't shine, and where the demons live. These planets are lit by the jewels on the hoods of the Nagas. And if you know the way, you can actually reach them through this planet. Just like, I mean, I don't think it's possible anymore, but the Pandavas went to the higher planets through the Himalayas. So there's a link, there's a connection. It's all part of the, Bhuloka. So they knew the way. They shot back down, and they were just like hanging out down in the lower planets. And, you know, Vishnu, he beats us every time. Do something about this, you know. It's too powerful. So they stayed there some time. And this is just actually before Ravan appeared, because he hadn't at that point appeared. Came. There was one of the demons, Sumali. He survived. Malayavan, I think he survived, because he's later appearing in the Ramayana. Sumali finally... Many thought the coast was clear, Vishnu's gone back to his abode, and it's safe to come out. So he came up, bringing his daughter, Kaikasi, with him. And and as he was sort of moving around, making sure the coast was clear. He saw Vaishravana, Kuvera, going over in the Pushpa Vimana, the beautiful chariot, flower chariot that he rides, Kuvera. And it's a stupendous sight. He was like, who's this person? Yeah. And he thought, well, how can I secure the good of the Rakshasas? I mean, we need something like that. Look at that. Look at, you know, and he's, Vaishravana is the son, of course, of Vishrava. Kuvera is the son of the sage, Vishrava. So he looked at his daughter and he thought, okay, if I can marry my daughter to Vishrava, and then we'll be in the same situation. We'll have all this opulence and wealth in the same way. So that's what he did. He sent Kaikasi to Vishrava, and she went before him at an inauspicious time, as they do. And she stood there, and then, you know, Vishrava's meditating, and opens his eyes, and there's this beautiful girl. And he says, well, what do you want? And she said, well, I think you know what I want. Literally. And he said, yes, you want sons by me, but you have come at the wrong time. So your sons will be hideous, will be, you know, terrible afflictors of the worlds and the gods. And, you know, they will be Rakshasas of the worst order. So the girl said, well, please, you know, be merciful. Don't give me terrible offspring. Give me nice, at least one nice child. So then he relented and said, yes, your last child will be very pious, devoted to the gods, devoted to Dharma. And, of course, that's Vibhishan. But the other, then she gave birth to Dasagriva. The ten-headed one, and that, of course, is Ravan. When he appeared, you know, the earth rocked, the seas heaved. Jai Shishi Radha Gokulananda Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman Ki Jai. And all kinds of inauspicious omens were seen. And then Kumbhakarna was born, and same sort of situation. Dasagriva, he was like Ravan, copperish in color, 10 heads, fierce mouth, 20 arms, you know, this terrible looking beast. He was initially. Later he got a boon that he could transform himself into any form that he liked, and he was able to, you know, appear human-like and very handsome. But initially, this was his native form. And then Kumbhakarna, the like of which had never been seen before. He was so massive, huge Rakshasa was born. And Sharpanaka. And then, of course, Vibhishan. So they then, you know, thought, okay, let us, you know, increase our opulence, because they also saw Kuvera, and they thought, oh no, we've got to do something about this. We'll do penance, austerity, sacrifice. So actually, again, you know, this is how the demons are being described, as having this mentality of, we shall do some sacrifices, and we shall rejoice and be happy. Actually, when we'll give charity, you know, they really think they're very very pious, and because when the demons were consulting about how to deal with Vishnu, they were saying, well, why should we have anything to fear? Dharma is situated in us. We've done sacrifices. We, you know, we're very righteous and good, so we have nothing to fear. So they think like that. And so they're actually prepared to undergo great sacrifice, great austerities, and to achieve their goal. See, the only difference is between them and the devotees is that their whole aim is to improve their own situation, to improve their own power, wealth, opulence, position in the world, and not to satisfy the Lord. But they're capable of some pretty serious hard work and sacrifice. I was one class where Prabhupada said, don't mock the heroic karmis, because, you know, it's actually quite difficult what they do. I mean, they undergo a great deal of stress and endeavor, rising at 5 in the morning, go to work even today, you know, to come back at 9 at night, 10 at night, and then again the next day, the next day, the next day. It's not easy. So anyway, these demons at this time had it figured out, and they thought, okay, well, we'll supplicate Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma is very good at granting boons, and his boons are very useful to have. So each of them went out, and, you know, Ravan, he had to perform this great austerity in midst of fires and water and everything, and every 10,000 years he cut off one of his heads and threw it into the fire. This is going to work. He's going to be impressed. So after 10,000 years and, you know, 90,000 years, one, you know, head went into the fire. Finally, 9 heads had gone. He's got 1 head left. And then Brahma says, he appears, I am pleased. What do you want? Phew. That was close. Actually, some say that his head kept growing back, but I think the account is that 9 of his heads went. And then, okay, so then what did he ask for? I choose immortality. Okay. So Brahma says, it's not in my power to grant you that. And he said, all right, then just grant me invincibility from... And then he runs off a list of all the gods, the demons, this, that class. He said, forget about humans, I'm worried about humans. I eat them for breakfast. Literally. So, Brahma, Tatash, too. And off he went. And that was Ravan sealing his fate very nicely. And then Kumbhakarna, then Vibhishan, he did a similar thing. He also performed penance and tapas. And at the end of it, Brahma came, and then here's the difference. He said, what would you like? And then Vibhishan said, I'm satisfied simply by seeing you. Why should I ask for anything? You know, this is the perfection that I have seen, a great personality like you. And then, you know, ask something. And so, you know, he said, let me always be fixed in Dharma. Let me always be fixed in the truth. So, you know, and this is the mentality, the difference between the pious and the impious. The impious, you know, give me something that improve my material situation and make me the champion, the top, the leader, you know, above everything and everyone. Whereas the pious, humble devotees are satisfied, you know, just to be fixed in Dharma. And he said at the time that because someone who's righteous, everything comes to him anyway. He's always peaceful and happy, and he doesn't have to strive for anything. It was similar like that with the Pandavas when Draupadi, after they'd lost everything, and then Dhritarashtra gave it all back, and then he was saying, ask for boons, and then, you know, Draupadi asked for her husband's to be released. What else would you like? Nothing else is required, because by their own virtue, they will acquire everything. Because those who are virtuous, they conquer everything. Vidura said, one who conquers his own self conquers the world. But they don't want the world. They conquer the world in the sense that they overcome the world. They overcome the attraction of the world. That's conquest. Conquest is not, no, I'm the emperor of the entire universe. Everyone bow to me. This is how the demons see it. Whereas the devotees understand conquest to mean overcoming those urges, those desires that, you know, I don't want anything. Because as long as you want something in this world, you're trapped in this world. And then you have to suffer in this world because there's, you know, janma, mrityu, jara, vyadhi, always there. Dukkha, dosha, anudarshanam. Keep that in sight. don't forget, because you can't avoid that. So devotees understand that the conquest of the world is to conquer my own senses, to conquer my own mind, and not be attracted by these things, which the demons completely, perversely refuse to accept. So, yeah, in this way, Vibhishan, and then Kumbhakarna. Kumbhakarna had already been foraging around in the universe, been going here and there and eating sages and, you know, and Gandharvas and different things, it said, the Apsaras. So he did his austerities in the same way, and then Brahma came to him, and then all the gods came to Brahma. Stop, stop, no boon at all should be granted to this one, because this is not going to be good. He's already wreaked havoc in the heavenly planets before he's got any kind of power and boons. So what would he be like if you do? So, you know, find some way to thwart him. So then Brahma called for Sarasvati and said, enter his, sit on his tongue when he asks for a boon. And solve this problem. So Sarasvati, yes, entered his mouth. And then the Kumbhakarna's like, oh, what do I want? And so he wanted to say, Nirdevata, let there be no gods. But in fact, he said, Nidratva, let there be sleep. So, from to task two. And I was thinking, oh, what did I just say? Why did I say that? As he's falling asleep, you know. Couldn't figure it out. And he's completely tricked by the gods. And that's, of course, why Kumbhakarna had slumbered for, you know, 6 months at a time. in this way, the Rakshasas, they were performing very, very severe penance and austerities, as they're quite prepared to do, in pursuit of their goals, which are always materialistic, and which never satisfy them. Actually, it's described how, you know, Kumbhakarna, he was always discontent. It's said about him that he was never contented, because you can't be contented. You know, even though you are like possessing the Nandanandana gardens, you're living in Amaravati or somewhere spectacularly beautiful. Beyond that, we can't even imagine currently what these places are like in the heavenly planets. But we can understand that they're still not going to satisfy us, that this is not what we're looking for. We shouldn't be desiring that kind of thing, because if we're intelligent, and we have to be intelligent, to understand that janma, mrityu, jarahavyadi, abrahma, bhuvanal loka, punarabhati, from the highest to the lowest, every planet is a place of misery, ultimately. And the enjoyment is just the other side of that coin of suffering. You can't, you know, one follows the other. As night follows day, misery follows enjoyment in this world. And then happiness comes and misery comes again. You can't have unadulterated happiness in material life. And even if you could, it still won't satisfy the soul. The soul needs something more. So that dissatisfaction was there, even with the Rakshasas, and that was Ravan also. We hear, you know, after he got his boons, and that's it, now, who's going to get me now? No one can kill me. He set off on his exploits, causing trouble everywhere he went, and, you know, ultimately bringing about his own destruction by kidnapping Sita. So the real problem is Rakshasas are there, sure, but the real problem is the desire. Actually, it's said, you know, that they have and that we also have. I think when we read Srila Prabhupada's books and purports, we can read them in different ways. We can read the Rakshasas, demons, rascals, you know, they need crushing. Or we can think, this is a problem which afflicts me. I have this problem. And actually it's said that in Kali Yuga, the Rakshasas and the devotees are born in the same body. And we can experience that. You know, that that these things which are being described here as the demonic nature are present in our own hearts. We have these doubts. These are demonic doubts. Asacham apratishtam te jagat ahur anishvaram. That, okay, when things are going nice and smoothly and, you know, we're happy and that's okay. Yeah, God, there's definitely a God and everything else, and, you know, we'll chant. When things aren't going so well, suddenly our life goes into a dip and a dive, and we're finding, you know, things very difficult, and we're struggling. Our faith is challenged, and these demonic doubts emerge. How can there be God? You know, where is Krishna? Why would he let this happen to me? You know, I'm his devotee, aren't I? You know, this should never happen to me. So we have to be cautious that, you know, this is the danger we face. The Rakshasas, we may not find them externally attacking us. We may, but for the most part, hopefully, we won't. Of course, some of them are in positions of leadership, and we have to suffer their taxes and things like that. That's something else. But apart from that, mostly the real danger is within. Actually, as I was saying previously, one who's conquered himself has conquered the world. He's got nothing to fear. Absolutely nothing, because he's fixed in the self. He's fixed in his eternal identity. He knows, I'm not this body. You can do what you like to the body, but it won't affect me. Anything can happen externally, but I won't be affected by that. This is the beginning of our transcendental realization. And ultimately, the end of it is, Krishna's there. I'm completely dependent on him. Everything is in his control. Everything happens according to his desire. And his desire is all good. Everything he does is perfect. And it's meant for my perfect happiness. He has no other desire. He's all good. It's not possible for Krishna to desire or to do anything harmful to anyone. We're all parts of him. He wants our elevation. So everything that's happening to us is for the good. Buddha said that everything is a blessing, but we need the blessings of being able to see that when it's happening. And we won't easily see that if we're not practicing properly our Krishna consciousness. And it's when things are going smoothly is when we have the best opportunity to do that, but it's when we're least likely to do it, because everything's going great, no problems at all, and then, bazoom, suddenly it's not going great, and it won't. It'll happen, because distress follows happiness, just as night follows day, and it will happen. And then it's like, what's going on? I can't drop my rounds. I've got too many things to do. You know, I haven't got time to read the books. I've got to sort this problem out. You know, I lost control, yeah. Yeah. I actually never had control, but now it's pretty obvious all of a sudden that it's not there. So what are we going to do about that? How are we going to prepare ourselves for that? That's the thing. And this is the real point, I think, that we need to take on board, that the Rakshasas are destroyed by God, ultimately. Even the demigods can't do it. You know, they call upon the Lord, and the Lord does it. And we have to do the same. But it's not a sentimental thing. When we call upon Krishna to help us, there's a process, there's a methodology. I was just looking at that, you know, how we can do that. And it's described, which is reading actually the Bhagavatam. And the real problem, of course, is anarthas in the heart, that, fundamentally the doubts arise due to the impurities in the heart. The anatta, and the basic anatta is, I'm this body, I'm this mind, I have these senses. I can, you know, this is me. And then from that flow all the other misconceptions and anattas, which assail us. And these are where the doubts will come. When they're always there. We just may not be aware of them. But they'll, under pressure, then they begin to emerge. So we can work on that. And we need to bring Krishna in order to destroy these demonic doubts. Madhusudan, the Lord who kills the demon of doubt. And that process is described in the Bhagavatam. Anato pasamam saksha bhakti yogam adhoksajaya. That the anarthas which are in the heart, like this is Vyasadeva just before compiling Bhagavatam. This is after he's Narada has come, and then he goes and he meditates at Samyaprasha, I think, and he has this vision, this great vision of reality, of truth, and he sees that the living entities are suffering unnecessarily because of the misconceptions, simply that they're thinking there's something they're not. And this is the anartha. And therefore, he compiled the Srimad Bhagavatam with the express aim of freeing the living beings from those anarthas, those misconceptions. It's simply a misconception. That's all anartha is. Anartha is thinking I'm something I'm not. This impurity in the heart. And it stems from wanting to be an enjoyer. And it's destroyed by Krishna coming in and like the sun entering the heart, clearing everything away. And we bring the Lord into our heart. How? By chanting his holy name nicely, and by the Bhagavatam, by hearing and assimilating the messages of the Bhagavatam. This is what it was compiled for. Actually, it says, Yashyavai Shriyamanayam, that Krishne Paramapurusha Bhakti Upadyate Pumsa Shoka Moha Bayapaha. So this is a wonderful verse that comes at that point of the seventh chapter of the Bhagavatam, that simply by giving oral reception, simply by hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, all these shoka, moha, bayapaha, Krishna Paramapurusha, the Lord immediately appears within the heart to destroy lamentation, illusion, and fear. So these are the problems we would like to solve. Illusion, fear, we're always assailed, we're always afflicted by these things, and it can be done. They can be destroyed simply by the process of hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. But we actually have to hear it. This is the thing. And assimilate those messages. They have to go into the heart. And it's described in the, in the Bhagavatam. Prabhupada talks about this process. How can we do that? Here's the translation of the verse, by the way. Due to the external energy, the living entity, although transcendental to the three modes of material nature, thinks of himself as a material product, and thus undergoes the reactions of material miseries. So actually our real position is we're transcendental to the modes of nature. That's the soul has nothing to do with matter. But he entangles himself in it by these thoughts of like, I am this body and, you know, so many things. And so thus he suffers. And Prabhupada comments, due to this unholy contact with the material energy, the pure spiritual entity suffers material miseries under the modes of material nature. So it's not required. It's something which is extraneous to us. Actually, it's a fact. Shankara said that a thing tends towards its nature. Therefore, the soul tends towards bliss all the time. If you think about it, why are we always trying to find happiness? Because that's our nature. We're actually blissful by nature. We don't want to suffer. You know, sometimes the Rakshasas like to say, you know, the demons, you gotta take the rough with the smooth. You know, if you don't have a bit of rough, you know, you can't appreciate the nice things in life. So you go, well, okay, how much rough would you like? Should I give you a bit of rough now so that you can taste the smooth later? So this is just madness. No one wants any rough at all. As soon as they're in the rough, they want to get out of it into the smooth. You know, it's like, it's not very pleasant. You know, so it's just pie in the sky, rubbish philosophies, actually. Pessimism, yeah, exactly. And indeed, that's our nature. Our nature is blissful. So this is being described in the Bhagavatam here, that we are transcendental to the modes of nature, to the suffering that we're undergoing, and we don't have to experience it. And simply by giving oral reception to the Vedic literature, the feeling for loving devotional service to Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, sprouts up at once. So this is actually stated there, immediately, to extinguish the fire of lamentation, illusion, and fearfulness. So this should be happening. Our experience, as we associate with the Bhagavatam, should be that this immediate effect is occurring, that we're feeling it at once, this freedom from the miseries of material existence. And all too often, I think the problem is that, you know, we don't, I mean, I hope that we're all actually attempting to associate with the Bhagavatam, at least. I know that quite often these days I talk to some devotees and they say, oh, I don't have time, I never read the Bhagavatam, which is a shame, because it can be done, it can be fitted in. I think one of the problems is that there was one famous business mentor who said that when you schedule your time, the first thing you should do is put in the important stuff, the stuff that matters, not the trivia, earning a living. It's a trivia, you know, and looking after your material situation. These are temporary things that will pass away with time. The most important thing is your soul. What are you doing for that? That's the main thing. So put that into your schedule first. And he gave an analogy, which some of you may have heard, that if you have a big jar and you know, you want to fill it with rocks, pebbles, sand, and water. So there's different ways you can go about it. If you put all water in first, then you can't get anything else in there. Or if you do, you know, the sand, the same thing, you're left, the rocks are out there, you can't get the rocks in. But if you start with the rocks and put them in the jar, then you'll find you'll get the pebbles in, and then there's still room for the sand, and then there's still room for the water, and then the rocks are in there. So the rock in our life is sadhana, is hearing and chanting, associating with Krishna, with Prabhupada, especially with Prabhupada, with Prabhupada's words. Because Shoka Moha by Apaha, that will have the effect of destroying these things. And our anatta, anatta upasamam sakshat, that we want these anattas to be annihilated. Because otherwise they'll annihilate us. Like the Rakshasas. The Rakshasas were annihilating the gods until they turned to Vishnu. And then Vishnu, riding on Garuda. And he says, I come on Garuda for my devotee and lift him out of this material world of suffering. So we can achieve that now simply by associating with the Bhagavatam, of course the Gita, same thing. Brahma Samhitam, it's the literary incarnation of the Lord. And it will have that effect. But we need to really be bringing it in, hearing it. I personally find that, you know, the best way to do that is to sit with other devotees and to discuss the subject matter, to, you know, churn it amongst ourselves. And then you start getting a connection with these very powerful words of Srila Prabhupada. And then you begin to feel that effect of your heart being purified and the the Rakshasa side of you being allayed and, you know, overcome. And if you don't, I find if I don't do that, when I'm not doing that, and, you know, sometimes you get overpowered, you know, oh, I've got to just leave it for a couple of days, I've got too many things to do, this and that, you know. Then you start feeling the incursion of the modes of nature. They're very always present, constantly. It's like you're under pressure, you're under the sea, you know, deeply under the sea in a submarine, you're constantly under pressure. Poke a little hole in the submarine and the water will rush in immediately. So similarly, you're constantly under pressure from the modes of nature. And if we let our guard down by not taking shelter of Prabhupada and Krishna, then the modes will just rush in and begin to overpower us. And then the problem is we get into such a state of confusion and illusion that we just don't see the solution as being taking shelter of Prabhupada, taking shelter of the Bhagavatam. But that's always the solution. So I think the message I get here from this purport is not to let the modern Rakshasa in my own heart overcome me. And as was the case here, invoking the presence of the Lord is the solution. Therefore, keep sadhana central to the program, central to everything I do. And hearing and chanting, especially in the association of devotees, satam prasangam mama virya sambhira bhavanti hritkana rasayana katha, because in that association, these accounts are like very pleasurable, very enjoyable, nectarian. And they are like nectar. It's some kind of madness that overcomes us when we think that there's no happiness, there's no nectar in the accounts of the Lord's divine pastimes, of all his pastimes, of his words. And we prefer to read other material. We get attracted by other material, like newspapers and the news, and, you know, the websites and trawling the internet. And this vast ocean of nectar is just lying there on our shelf, waiting for us to dive in. And we're ignoring it. And we're denying ourselves, actually, something very wonderful, which is a shame, because, you know, human life is rushing by very, very swiftly. And we don't want to be left regretting it. This same person who spoke about the rocks and the sand and everything said that no one on their deathbed is thinking, I should have spent more time in the office. You know, I should have earned more money. You know, why didn't I get that Jaguar? Blimey. Wasted my life. You know, that's not what you're going to be thinking at that time. So, intelligence means to, you know, think forward like that. You know, what will matter most? What actually has value in my life? Human life is meant for acquiring values. And it has, you know, real value. What's of real value? Value is that which is not going to be lost with time. If it's going to be lost with time, it's as good as lost already. What's the point in getting it? You may as well not bother. You know, all these things are like flowers, akasha pushpa in the sky. They're just going, coming and going. Like, you know, wealth seen and lost in a dream. Everything in this material world is like that. It has no substance. So if we're spending our entire time chasing all of that, we're being very foolish and we're denying ourselves something much, much more wonderful and substantial. And that lies in these pages here that we have, all of us have access to, that we've been fortunate enough to be given by the grace of Srila Prabhupada. So let's not lose that opportunity. So it's 8:45. I don't know if anyone would like to. I think I should stop speaking so that more esteemed devotees here could perhaps say something. If anyone has any questions, comments, or points they'd like to make, then please, I'd love to hear it.